Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Dr. Erica McAllister is my very special guest for this extra episode. She's the author of Secret Life of Flies and is just about to release her next book, The Inside Out of Flies. She's one of my entomology heroes, an excellent scientist, shares my fascination for bloodsuckers, and has a drive to answer all sorts of questions from the curious public. We met at the Field Museum of Natural History, where Erica took some time out of her tour of the insect collection to come and meet me at my day job in the museum's basement. We had so much fun talking about flies and their associated myths, so I hope you have fun listening to it too. Today we have a very special Tiny Vampires episode where I have a guest host.
Hello. Hello, everyone. My name is Erica McAllister, and I'm one of the senior curators at the Natural History Museum in London, specifically working on flies and fleas.
Yeah, which is the best.
Yep.
All the blood-sucking groups. Our interaction kind of started on Twitter with a cartoon. Do you want to describe it?
Oh, yeah, it's a cartoon that actually made me giggle inappropriately for hours. So it's two males, cartoon males, and one of them, a mosquito lands on his arm, and the other's like, dude, you've got a mosquito on your arm. And he's like, it's all right, I just let them feed. And then the mosquito explodes, and the guy's like, oh, and the other guy's face is one of pure horror. And the original guy who's been fed on says, better get my blood pressure checked, yeah. Which just made me giggle a lot.
Yeah, especially as somebody that I've had to feed mosquitoes on my arm before is like, it's like kind of identifying. So I decided that we would kind of talk about different mosquito and fly myths, because that's one of those myths that like a mosquito feeding on your arm can explode.
Nope.
Yeah. But before we get into some of the myths, let's get into like a little bit of background first. So the question you get all the time, what is a fly in the broadest sense of the term?
So flies are slightly annoying because I'm going to tell you the three things that make a fly and then tell you that there's loads of flies that don't do any of that. So a fly, as an adult, it has suctorial mouth parts. So you can never be bitten by a fly. You can be sliced, maimed, pierced, you know, all of that. But you can't actually be bitten because they've only got sucking mouth parts. Mm-hmm. They have one pair of wings. So this is the nice, obvious distinguishing thing between them and, say, wasps mm-hmm. and bees. But there's a lot of flies that don't have wings just to kind of play with your head.
Yeah.
And then they have a pair of halters, which are their proprioceptors, their gyroscopic organs. So why flies are arguably the best flies on the planet is because of all these sensory organs. Mm-hmm. So, and it also, it's not just helping them fly, but it means that how they walk upside down and things like that, walk up really slightly. These little receptors are the ones actually helping them keep their balance. Mm-hmm. Again, there's flies without these.
Yeah, because they have to be difficult.
Of course. And then there's flies where the adults don't have mouth parts, really. Mm-hmm. So again, you're like, oh, flies, really?
Yeah.
So I understand that there's a slight problem with them, but they're very worthwhile.
Yeah.
That mosquitoes long piercing mouth part, delicate wings, delicate bodies, mm-hmm. scales and wings, and you're like, ah, it's a mosquito.
Yeah.
Yep. So there are some that are non-biting midges that look alike, and the males, again, are really, really fluffy, just mm-hmm. like the male mosquitoes, but the mouth parts separate them.
Yeah. How many species of flies are there? It's a hard question.
It's a very hard question. There are only the top four orders of insects, so arguably one in 10 animals on the planet is a fly. Mm-hmm. When it comes to number of species description, I believe we're in about 170,000-180,000. I could be lying. We're very underdescribed. Flies, they haven't got the publicity and the historic love-ins mm-hmm. that the butterflies and moths and the beetles have. But when it comes to total species diversity, we realize that the flies, along with the bees and wasps and ants, are probably going to just dominate. Just to give you, in the UK, for example, there's, 3,000 species of butterflies and moths, and I think it's 4,000 of beetles, I think it's something like that, but there's over 7,000 species of fly.
Oh, wow.
There's more species of fly in our country than there are mammals on the planet. Kind of put it in perspective.
Yeah. I mean, that's when you, once you start diving into the invertebrate world, it's a whole nother ballgame.
It is. And there's so many more species out there, and there's so many flies have got really cryptic species. Mm-hmm. So like Anopheles gambii, the big mosquito mm-hmm. that's the big vector, it's one in about, I think it's 7 species. Mm-hmm. They all look alike. They just behave a little bit differently, and you're like, ah.
Yeah.
And it's quite annoying, but it's also very important because mm-hmm. we might be trying to kill species that don't transmit the malaria.
Right.
So, or we may be trying not to kill more species mm-hmm. that do. So we've got to be really careful about this.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that I've talked a lot about on the show is vector competence.
Yeah.
And so it's so important to tell the difference between two species because,
really? Yep.
because one might have fantastic vector competence and one might not. Yeah. And at a glance, they look the same.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've seen some horrific things in my time when it comes to insect repellents.
Oh, yeah.
Where they put crane flies on the front of the box.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, now this is really bad because not only are you going out and killing the harmless crane flies, but they also meaning the public aren't figuring out which ones aren't. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole lot of high level ignorance by these companies. It's like, it's all right, they all look alike, don't they?
Yeah.
And you're like, no.
Yeah.
It's like putting an elephant and then saying it's a rhinoceros.
Yeah. And, like, and some of the insects that they're showing are actually ones that kill mosquitoes when they're in their larval form.
Yeah, no, well, it's, I don't know. The toxorhynchites.
Yeah.
Yeah, those beautiful,
yeah.
beautiful mosquitoes. They look really scary. They look crazy. Vegetarians as adults, both the females and the males, and the larvae, they're lovely. I was collecting in South Africa. Mm. I was collecting another type of mosquito. It took me weeks to find it.
Yeah.
I put out my little bowls. I was ringing up all the mosquitoes. It's all generally lovely. I came in the next day. All my little larvae are gone, apart from one really fat larvae, and I'm like...
Just happy as a clam.
Yeah, really, really happy, and I'm like, I know what you are. Yeah, great.
So, in flies, there are a lot of blood feeders, like more than in other groups of insects. So, how many blood feeders are there, and like, why?
Yeah. Well, no, because you think about the whole of fleas, the whole thing of blood feeders.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
So, but they are quite alike. So,
yeah.
It makes sense because it's very, very nutrient rich. Mm-hmm. So, it's only the females in most cases, mm-hmm. not all the cases, that are blood feeders. Because she uses it as an extra nutrient bonus for egg development.
Mm-hmm. So you need a lot of protein to make it.
Huge, yeah. yeah. These mothers are going all out there to look after their babies. We can't have a go at them for being the best mothers.
Yeah.
You know, it's how. So both of them nectar feed, the males and the females nectar feed, and then the females will supplement her diet extra on top. Mm-hmm. Now that is the case with all the blood feeders apart from the tsetse. Mm-hmm. And the tsetse flies, which are, the rest of them are all in the lower flies. The tsetses mm-hmm. are in the higher flies. And both the males and the females blood feed here. Mm-hmm. And these are more unusual is the tsetses give birth to live young.
Yeah.
Which is the most fascinating and
Horrifying.
Horrifying.
Yeah, when you think about it from a human perspective. So I just talked about this in my previous episode, that is basically like giving birth to a 14-year-old.
And the fact that she lactates internally, she's feeding internally.
Yeah.
That the idea of something that large coming out of me is just, it's quite horrifying, so I can't go there anymore. It's amazing. So, you know, those two. And it's interesting what a lot of these blood feeders, why they have such a bad time is because they are vectors.
Mm-hmm.
But we're understanding so much more about vector manipulation now. So the tetses, when they have a trypanosome infection, they act differently. They behave differently because of this parasite.
Mm.
And we see this in mosquitoes. So she would feed more. She would go into different environments. All sorts of things happen when she's got the malarial protozoan inside her.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this crazy manipulation going on.
Yeah.
So I always feel bad for mosquitoes. And
yeah.
I know that's terrible.
Because it's like the behavior is more risky.
Yes.
Because like more biting means
absolutely.
Their chances of being swatted or something like that absolutely. Is so much higher.
Imagine sitting in a restaurant and something's going to come along and stamp on you. Puts a little bit more edge.
Right.
On our feeling.
Yeah.
Like no lingering romantic moments over the candles. Like, we got to get out of here.
Incredibly stressful time for her, which is something that I think most people wouldn't really consider. Like, we almost think of them as like villains, like coming in, but really it's more like they're dashing in and
every
out.
Every single part of their life cycle.
Like, the mosquito doesn't want the parasite any more than we want to catch it from them.
Exactly. And it's, I think this is something, obviously I'm not saying that we should keep all mosquitoes. I am saying that we need to think about if we're going to break the disease, we break that barrier.
Mm-hmm.
We don't wipe out the mosquitoes. There's 3,300 species of mosquito, of which only 150 of them are really important vectors. And the idea of being able to go out and wipe out species of mosquito fills me with a certain, look, I think we need to really probably understand, because again, when one does one species stop, another species start.
Right.
And I worry about this with vectors.
And
they are, you know, the males, they're good pollinators.
Yeah.
And we've done so little research into pollinator ecology in a lot of these neglected groups. Mm-hmm. I think this is other areas. And we're looking at mosquitoes for all sorts of exciting stuff now when it comes to bio-inspired products. So how their mouth parts manipulate under the skin. I just think it's amazing, the idea. They can't even see what's going on, and they know, you know, how to pick up all the blood cues under their skin.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible. Yeah, my graduate research was actually on studying which plants mosquitoes feed on. And this is something that we don't know because we've just now started to think of them as animals and not just flying syringes.
And it's interesting, but still people don't even count them as flies.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we've got a long way. They don't even realize they're flies, let alone animals.
Right.
And it is often insects and other animals is my favorite.
Definitely. Oh, yes.
Yes, and then mosquitoes and the flies. And I'm okay, we've got a long way to go with the public.
Yeah, yeah. So that's what we're here for, is talking about myths that that people have kind of perpetuated, so we can kind of get back to talking about that cartoon. Like, I guess, why was it so ridiculous? So, like, why is it that our blood pressure doesn't actually impact the mosquito?
So our blood pressure isn't that high.
Yeah.
It can never be that high. Sadly, we can't do it. Theoretically, you can blow up an aphid. But I don't know whether that's true. I've heard rumors of it. But yeah, no. And you've got neurological control.
Mm-hmm.
Mosquitoes are thinking. Mm-hmm. They're not going to let themselves get blown up.
Yeah.
So I believe that you can, if you, you know, disrupt their neurological pathway so they don't think about it, they can overfeed.
Yeah.
But, you know, they naturally themselves can't do it. They've got pumps going on.
Mm-hmm.
They've got all sorts of constrictions going on. So they hit a limit. They're like, that's actually fine.
Yeah. So it's similar to us. We have a sensation. Yeah. We have a sensation of feeling full.
Yes.
And so we just stop eating.
Exactly.
So,
and, you know, she's not going to hang around.
Yeah.
We're a very dangerous environment to feed on.
Oh, yeah.
So she needs to get out, you know, the minimal amount that she needs for her egg meal, for egg development, and then she's out of there. There's just no way she's going to go, this is great.
Yeah, just hang out.
I'm going to hang out here. Yeah. Oh, look, there's a hand.
Yeah. So warm.
Yeah.
Yeah. It seems like there must be, like evolutionarily speaking, something about flies that, something about their mouth parts that makes it easy for them to transition from like nectar feeding into blood feeding.
Yeah.
Do you have any idea of like what that might be?
You know, and then they've got these brilliant pumps. Mm-hmm. So they've got the again like they've got up to 6 pumps in their heads.
Oh wow.
So yeah, so yeah. For taking up the nectar and taking up the fluid, mm-hmm. exactly same principle of taking up blood very quickly.
Right. So it's like just easy to adapt from from one to the other.
But nectar is no way as good as a food source as blood is. Yeah.
Because it's like just sugar.
Yeah, basically. Exactly.
It's like just eating Twinkies all day.
Having never eaten a Twinkie, I generally don't think I ever want to.
I don't think you're missing out too much.
Good.
Yeah.
No. Now I feel quite nauseous.
Sorry.
Back to blood.
Yeah.
I think I can cope with that better.
Yeah, that's how you know you belong on the show. So you were saying that like different blood feeding flies have different types of mouth parts. Like what's kind of the spectrum that we're looking at?
So you've got, so a horse fly, for example, and mm-hmm. anyone who's ever been bit, well, I say bitten.
Yeah.
I use that as a term.
Yeah.
And been attacked by a horse fly lady. They will know that they hurt.
Oh yeah.
Because she still has primitive mandibles and mm-hmm. we don't think about flies having mandibles, the very toughened part of the mouth parts, which she uses to slice your flesh.
Mm-hmm.
It's always a good description. And then yeah. she laps up the pooling blood, which is very nice. But again, she's got mouth parts she can suck it up. Mm-hmm. You've got, sorry, I should probably start with the more primitive ones, like the sand flies, the biting midges, mm-hmm. the black flies and the mosquitoes. You know, they've got these proper suctorial mouth parts, various different lengths, and some of them can be quite sharp and mm-hmm. piercing and stabby. And then you go through to things like stomoxes, which mm-hmm. is in the housefly family. So we think of the houseflies as the vomiters.
Yeah.
Yeah, they've got these nice paddy, fleshy mouth parts, which mm-hmm. They've got these pseudotracheal pads, so they lap up these partially digested fluids, etc.
Yeah.
But there's one type which we call the stable flies, the stomoxes,
mm-hmm.
and oh boy. And you can, their mouth parts look like slightly inverted vases, you call vases.
Yeah.
Okay, so think about a very like long tube vase going into you and it's got sliced little scissors teeth at the end of it okay. that it shreds through your flesh.
Yeah.
Fantastic stuff. But it is apparently the tsetse, and I've never been bitten by a tsetse.
Yeah.
But apparently they are the most painful when it comes to, because again, it just forces quite a large mouth part proboscis into you.
Yeah, and you can see, like, when you see a photo of them, their mouth parts are huge.
They are formidable.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, I mean, the mosquito mouth parts, they are sheathed. And only a tiny bit of it will go, actually, of the different stylets will go into your, and it's beautiful. It's such a mad way of how she protects it and how she looks after it and,
mm-hmm.
and keeps it clean. Whereas, like, the stomoxes and the tsetse, they're out there. They're just ready, you know, I'm going to get in there. And the horsefly's like, do you want to really start? A horse fly, and you're like, okay.
Yeah. But. So it's just so because it's such a painful bite, do they feed more quickly?
Well, your blood pools quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So she's able to get it fast.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the biggest issue, apart from her near death of trying to avoid being killed by whatever, mm-hmm. is the coagulation of the blood. So she has to, you know, release an anticoagulant,
mm-hmm.
and she has to keep feeding fast. Otherwise, it just heals very quickly.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Or you get smack.
You get the smack.
Yeah.
We have one of my favorite collections of horse flies in the collection.
Mm-hmm.
They are about a millimeter thick.
Mm-hmm.
So they have been collected.
Oh, my gosh. That.
So if you look at them from one way, they look like perfect specimens, and then you turn them 90 degrees and you're like, oh, hold on a minute.
Yeah, they're like a piece of paper.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So does that make it more difficult to identify them.
Yeah, it's not the best.
Yeah.
Yes, it's not ideal.
Yeah.
It's interesting. We're now looking at, I've got a project running where we're looking at historic DNA from whole genome, mitochondrial genome, from our mosquito collection going back 100 years.
Oh, wow.
But what we're also starting to think about is taking the blood meal out of the abdomens.
Oh, yeah.
So this is where it gets very interesting. So we're actually going to be able to incriminate for the first time what they're feeding on. Because obviously most mosquitoes are bird feeders. They're not mammal feeders.
Yeah.
So it'd be really nice to actually go, you know what, all of this lot you let off.
Yeah.
But also then we can look at the plasmodium if we have any of them. Because avian malaria is a huge thing.
Oh, yeah.
And in terms of conservation now, we've got mosquitoes moving into different regions. And so suddenly these populations of birds that were like penguins that weren't affected will now be affected because mosquitoes bringing in hosts, bringing in these plasmodia are going to go in. So it's interesting how techniques we use for humans to understand it, vector analysis, we can now start using for conservation as well.
Right. Because I know that's it's a huge problem in Hawaii because there was never there were never mosquitoes transmitting avian malaria there, and it's wiped out quite a few of the bird species.
We have a problem in, say, London Zoo.
Oh, really?
Yeah, okay. So now all our birds are on anti-malarials.
Oh, jeez.
Well, because they're the penguins. They weren't used to it. They came to London. It's like, hey, what's going on? Oh, there's mosquitoes.
Yeah.
Oh, damn.
What on earth is this?
Yeah,
thing?
And there were several deaths.
Yeah.
We can't have penguins dying. The public would just be like, no.
They're too cute.
Too cute. You can't have that. And it's like, whoops, killed another penguin. Obviously, this doesn't happen now, and London Zoo is fine, and it's hilarious.
Right. One of the myths that I've come across over the time that I've been doing this show is that viruses, because they can transmit viruses like West Nile, they could also transmit viruses like HIV.
Nah.
And but like why is it that they can transmit some and not others?
There's a big size difference in the viruses themselves.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So that was one of the things that they can't do it. And they just don't take that much blood. So with certain things that it's going to be easily transmitted and others it won't. And HIV has just not been one of those viruses that mosquitoes get on well with.
Yeah.
So.
Because it has to be adapted to their, to live in their bodies, because it has to be in there for some time.
Yeah, and HIV is relatively new. So Western Nile, dengue, malaria. Malaria's been around, you know, although that's a plasmodium rather than a virus.
Yeah.
But, you know, these are things that have, I mean, dengue is the one that worries me.
Yeah.
Our climate is changing fast. Our migratory routes amongst humans, we are rapidly moving everywhere.
Yeah.
We you know, we don't settle anymore. And so all of these things are just going to get worse rather than get better.
Yeah. So, you know, getting that funding and keeping these things in the front of our minds, even though it seems like something like Zika isn't as much of an issue anymore because, you know, we just have these massive vector control districts that are controlling it for us. But
I mean, we have to think about how we're controlling it.
Right.
And a lot of people were like, I mean, the classic when malaria was the bed nets. And it was like, hold on, it worked in Africa. Why can't we just use bed nets everywhere? And it's like, because you've got different mosquitoes.
Yeah.
You've got mosquitoes in Africa that feed at night and you've got mosquitoes in Indonesia. They feed in the evenings. So we've got to get through that actually this is really important and we keep doing this research. We're looking at loads of different types of mosquitoes. We're looking at them at doing different activity, carrying different diseases, all sorts of things.
Yeah.
So we've got so much work to do.
It's really motivating
to
know how much this kind of work can impact human health.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But also, if you get rid of the mosquitoes, what is the knock-on effect there? So we've got to think about environmental health as well.
Right, right.
So we are one species on a planet.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we need to look at ourselves more and involve what's going on. So this is why we need to trial all these different ways of doing what's best for all.
Right.
And it was interesting when they did all the tsetse work in Africa and they went in and they got rid of tsetse in loads of regions. They other tsetses came in from other regions, so they brought in different. So you create different problems. We got to be careful to think through long-term strategies of what the impact of our little short-term ways of deleting the problem there and then.
It's what might be expedient might not be what's what in the long term is what we really should be doing. I've kind of been interested in public health for a while, and one of my favorite concepts that's come about recently is the concept of One Health, which is bringing in ecologists into public health, bringing in veterinarians and like wildlife ecologists, and saying, you know, something that is killing white-tailed deer right now might impact human health later. And if we take care of the entire system, we can not only prevent diseases, but we can kind of create a healthier all-around balanced ecosystem.
Absolutely agree with this. Absolutely. And I think it's definitely the way forward. I'm an ecologist. I come from an ecology background.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea of taking species in separation.
Yeah.
I can't see how that will ever work. And we are one of the species on the planet, and we need to think about the impact of all of it and making it a healthier environment for all.
Mm-hmm.
So when we go in with disease control, we have to think about the greater picture, the holistic picture, and doing it like that.
So we talked a little bit about dengue, and one of the myths that has come out of Puerto Rico is that if you catch dengue more than once, then it's 100% fatal. Can you talk a little bit about that?
It's not 100% fatal.
Yeah.
But you are definitely weaker because of it. And we were, as field biologists, we would think twice after we've got dengue about going back, because the probability is, because you've been so immunosuppressed or weakened, it's harder.
Yeah.
I'm slightly optimistic about vaccines with it.
Yeah.
So that seems to be very progressive at the moment, which would be good.
Mm-hmm.
So
I'm sure this is one is a myth that you hear a lot, is that houseflies are filthy and covered in disease. So if this is true, what kind of diseases are they actually transmitting?
Okay. So they're not covered in disease. Let's get rid of that. They're arguably some of the cleanest organisms on the planet, because they have to be.
Mm-hmm.
If they're covered in crap, they can't fly. Their body is covered in sensors.
Mm-hmm.
So mechanical sensors, sensory, you name it, they are covered in these sensors.
Mm-hmm.
So if they've got stuff all over them, it's not going to be good for them. However, saying that, they do eat feces. They do eat partially digested things. They eat from environments that have a lot of bacterium. So then they can regurgitate this onto other food sources. And often they will, if they can walk through stuff, although they've got taste sensors on their feet.
Mm-hmm.
So again, they will want to. How many times have you watched a fly clean itself?
Oh, yeah, all the time.
All the time. They're obsessed by cleaning.
Yeah.
In fact, what's really fun, and don't do this, if you cut off their front pair of legs, they will learn to use their second pair of legs.
Oh, wow.
So they will take a little bit of time, because it's more important for them to clean than it is to do anything else in many ways, because they have to make sure it's all done. So they are all about the clean. But, and there is work coming out about the pathogen spread because of the partially digested.
Mm-hmm.
So my advice is cover up food, but we really do need them.
Yeah.
Regurgitating this food and getting rid of our waste. Please don't kill them. just look after your own area.
Yeah.
Humans are quite, we're quite bad at keeping clean.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of like I wouldn't like to cast aspersions about everybody, but I know that at times I can be quite lazy about certain food practices of leaving food out.
Yeah.
So, and they can smell this food from a long way away.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they're such good little detectives. Smell a corpse out from nowhere.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, if people have cats and dogs.
Yeah.
Okay. You're dealing with probably way more products being walked into and around your house than a fly could possibly produce. Cats cleaning themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, a cat cleans himself, fly cleans himself. Cat can be covered in all sorts of stuff, and then a cat licks your face, just saying.
And nobody thinks twice.
Nobody thinks twice. You know, I shake hands with you, I don't know where you've been. I handle money.
Oh, yeah.
Money is covered with everything. Mm-hmm. You really do not know how many fecal samples are going to be on money. And it's like, there's a lot worse going on out there.
Right, right.
Plus, they're really good pollinators, flies, house flies. You know, we're starting to use them. Think about several species in greenhouses.
Mm-hmm.
So, everyone hates flies, and we've just got to get over it.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't have chocolate if it wasn't for flies.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
Plus, the bloodsuckers and the predators, there's these new venoms to science.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's all sorts of fun things coming out of what we might not necessarily like. Don't want to slam any doors.
Yeah.
I want to keep everything open. We don't want to get rid of an animal from the environment if we don't know the impact it has in that environment.
Right.
Yeah, we don't know what tools it can offer us in the future, what insights it can. It's, you know, we're now looking at bio-inspired technology differently, and we're suddenly going, hold on, the insects have been doing it for a long time.
Yeah. So we talked about some of the myths that I've heard around. Some of the fly myths that you've had to debunk over
crane
your career.
Flies.
Yeah.
It's always the crane fly. Erica, is it true that the crane fly is the most venomous creature on the planet? It's just that they don't have mouth parts to pierce, whatever. I'm like, okay, right, crane flies. So lots of flies do have piercing mouth parts. Mm-hmm. We've been discussing this.
Yeah.
Why would the crane flies go, do you know what? I'm going to make myself the most venomous, but just have really crap mouth parts.
Yeah. What's the
let's
point
think
of that?
About that.
Yeah.
Evolutionally, let's just take a step back.
Yeah.
So, no, they have no venom.
Mm-hmm.
They do have functional mouth parts, some of them, but most of them short-lived as adults.
Because it's all about breeding at that point.
Adults, it's all about adult time.
Yeah.
I like to actually call it adult time and dispersal and migration.
Mm-hmm.
So the majority of the life cycle, I was having this discussion yesterday on Twitter. Someone was going about hoverflies. And they're going, yeah, but, I mean, we're talking about adults. And I'm like, no, hoverfly is the name for the whole of the life cycle.
Yeah.
But we don't think about their immature stages, the larval stages. They're still hoverflies. And that's the problem with common names as well.
Oh, yeah.
So, harvestmen.
Mm-hmm.
So, daddy long legs.
Yeah.
So, crane flies, they call daddy long legs. Harvestmen, they call daddy long legs. And daddy long legs spiders, they call daddy long legs.
Yeah.
And two out of the three of those have no venoms.
Yeah.
So, and even the cellar spiders, the daddy long leg spiders, their venom is really quite pathetic.
Yeah.
It's like me pinching you at the most.
Yeah.
With that. It's like, oh, it's that.
Yeah.
So, no, that myth is just totally.
Mm.
One of my favorite ones is about horse flies, and it was some guy who wrote about this, that it took ages to be debunked, which was silly because it was stupid, that it flew so fast it could break the sound barrier. But he said he saw that, which is like, oh, really? Hold on a minute, there's a whole lot going on wrong. And no, so that was a nice, fun myth,
yeah.
But that was just a terrible myth.
I just imagine what the sonic boom would be.
Yeah. Wouldn't, and then, there goes the fly, because it's just, another one I like is that all insects are terrestrial. And it's like, no, because there's loads of flies that are marine.
Yeah.
I mean, there's loads of other creatures, but it's all about the flies.
Yeah.
So the fact that some flies spend their whole life in marine environments, there's things that people don't expect.
Mm-hmm.
And there's things that people just keep going, isn't this the case? Flies without wings freaks people out. They're like, are they walks? No.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, but they're like, so what makes them a fly? And I'm like, oh. Right, here we go. I have to try and explain the evolutionary process of how they got to where they are.
Yeah. So are there any other myths that you wanted to get off your chest, I guess?
No, I think the myth that the flies, you know, that they're just revolting, they're pointless, and they shouldn't be here. I mean, if you get rid of flies, I mean, just take the fact that they do feed on a lot of things we don't like.
Mm-hmm.
Good.
Yeah.
Because imagine if they didn't.
Yeah.
I don't want to be swimming in a pile of feces. I do not want to have all these decomposing bodies anywhere. The myth that they don't pollinate, well, we know that probably half the families are pollinators, if not more. They're so important. We wouldn't have mangoes. We wouldn't have carrots. We wouldn't have coriander. We wouldn't have parsley. We wouldn't have peppers. We wouldn't have black pepper. All of these things predominantly pollinated by flies. So, and everything else from their medical importance to their venoms to all of these different things, they're architecture. I mean, how fly flies.
Yeah.
How it walks. Very amazing.
Yeah.
All of these things going on. I think it's about time we stop just dissing on flies stop and start to appreciate their wonders.
And speaking from, like, the medical standpoint, it's not only that they're doing bad things.
They're doing really good things.
Yeah, the reintroduction of medical maggots.
Maggot debridement therapy. You can get it on the NHS in the UK. Well, we still have it.
Yeah.
And that's very good. But you're also looking at, think about maggots, where they live. Mm-hmm. A lot of them live in really nasty environments. Why aren't they getting pathogens?
Mm.
Why aren't they getting disease? Because they themselves, they have a coating on that.
Mm-hmm.
We are looking at that coating to think about how we can use it ourselves, to how we can make pills and medicine.
So medically important, not just in one direction.
Yeah.
Which is another thing that we need to embrace.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things that I really like to talk about on Tiny Vampires is how we have figured all of these things out. So to that end, can you talk something about how museum research and how museum collections actually impact disease prevention from, like, the mosquito aspect?
Museum collections are inventory.
Mm-hmm.
They're in time and space.
Mm-hmm.
So we have collections that date back, the Natural History Museum go back 300 years. But they have a geographical space across the whole globe. So at points in time, we can tell you what species was found where. This is incredibly important when it comes to an individual country, let's say Indonesia, wants to know what mosquitoes are there. But it can go ask the rest of the world and we can say, we have found all these species in your country at this point.
Yeah.
Straight off, there's that. So we get a hit list of what's in what country.
Right.
And then many people thought that was great. That's what collections do. And then we start to look at them. We can say, actually, in Indonesia, we found that species moved because we've got date labels. And we could say, okay, and then this species came in, so we could start looking invasives.
Right.
So that was great for collections that moved it on. But now we've got the molecular techniques. We can start asking all sorts of really, really fun questions from our specimens.
Mm-hmm.
We can use it to look at when insecticide resistance came in.
Mm-hmm.
We can look at it for its diet. We can look at our species or the speciation.
Yeah.
We can incriminate what were cryptic species we couldn't do before. So this helps us understanding really what was going on in previous populations and how we can relate to them now.
Yeah.
We can look at whether they were carrying Plasmodia.
Mm-hmm.
We can look at the blood meal. We can look at all sorts of things.
Yeah.
We can also look at what they were eating in terms of their nectar. We can use micro CT scanning to look at the stomach contents and to incriminate what the pollen was. We got all of these new things that our collections do. And what we can do now, because I like to see it as paying it back, we have got these collections from all around the world that we have. We are digitizing them. We are scanning them. That information now goes online. It's free. It's accessible. So everywhere around the world can access collections that were caught in their own countries. Finally, we can give back. So it is a really useful and a really important time for collections. And also something we've got to think about, we still need to add to them. We still need to have these continuous time frames.
Right.
It is so important in understanding how everything interacts and what's going on. We've got the Insectageddon. We know that we are now going through this terrible time. We're seeing species loss everywhere.
Yeah.
If we didn't have a lot of these museum collections, we wouldn't know what was there in the first place. But they are missing huge amounts of data. So we need people to keep going out there and doing this.
Because if you're saying, what was in Cambodia in 1968?
Yep.
If somebody wasn't collecting in 1968, you have nothing. And if you're seeing something in the decade before and you're not seeing it in the decade after, you don't know what was happening in between. And the same is true for now. So if we're not constantly collecting these animals, then there's no way to know.
It's so hard for us to identify many of these species without doing dissections.
Mm-hmm.
I play with genitalia a lot.
Yeah.
Much to my parents' glee.
Yeah.
I'm like, no, I get paid for it. Honestly, it's a professional thing. So we do need the actual specimens. It's not like with birds, you could do a lot from IDs, because suddenly we realize, so we were looking at a mosquito in Indonesia and realized it wasn't one mosquito, it's four species. Mm-hmm. But if we'd have only had pictures or data points, we couldn't have gone back and told you which one was where.
Yeah.
So suddenly our historical information about this species is completely wrong.
Yeah.
But we have the specimens, so we can go back and we can probably figure out which specimen was found where. And it helps us understand, because two of these four species didn't transmit malaria.
Yeah.
So suddenly it becomes very important.
Right. Right. So. And not only is it a targeting issue, it's also why is one good at transmitting and why is the other not?
So we need the physical specimens to be able to look at it properly. We're starting, you know, we've suddenly got a plethora of new techniques, from genomics to scanning to all of these, the digitization, everything that helps us bring these specimens back once into the fore.
Right. So it was collected 200 years ago, but we're getting brand new information.
Absolutely.
Out of it.
Absolutely. And I know, who knows what's going to happen in 10 years' time.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely, it's an essential time. It's a fun time. It's a crazy time.
Yeah.
What we can ask from that one specimen now is like, wow, I'm no longer just looking at you thinking you're amazing. I am now thinking about all sorts of things that you can do.
At every scale.
Absolutely.
From molecular all the way to the ecosystem that it was living in. You can get all of that from just one sample.
I know.
And how many samples do you have?
Yeah, a lot.
Yeah.
And we have, I think, the estimate, I believe it's 34 million.
Yeah.
Estimate. You can come and count.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So.
Well, I mean, with insects, it gets tricky.
It gets tricky. Yeah.
Because, like, you have a whole jar full of maggots. You're not going to sit there and count them.
No.
Yeah.
I've just been to the collection here.
Yeah.
And, again, you've got hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of jars waiting to be looked through.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, wow, do you know how much information is just waiting to be explored?
Yeah.
Which is quite fun.
And a lot of the people who are doing that work are just volunteers. Yeah.
But if the volunteers and the amateurs, I don't like that word, people who aren't getting paid to do it are the lifeblood. I mean, the UK... Yeah. Most of the people who are working on flies are going to be people who are not paid in that area.
Mm-hmm.
We have the Dipterus Forum, and there's 400 members. And right now they're running around. They've been collecting. They will identify. They do. Well, there's a lovely lady who's rearing up loads of different types of soldier flies in her kitchen to look at the larvae and to identify which larvae is associated with adult, how they feed, everything.
Yeah, because a lot of the body type information that you need to identify the species is only for the adult. So that's what she's doing.
Yeah. So mosquitoes, we call it link rearing. We call it with everything.
Yeah.
Because the link mosquitoes, when they shed their third instar skin, we keep that and we put it on a slide. And then when they shed their pupal case, we keep that. And then we keep the adult. And interestingly, we don't kill the adults 24 hours because we let their genitalia rotate.
Oh,
it's place. You make sure it's correct.
Yeah.
It's always difficult for identification afterwards.
Yeah.
And this is great because then we can go into other environments and they don't catch the adults. They've only got a little larvae collection and say, yes, it's this.
Yeah.
But mosquitoes are very different.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot more people researching them and they do this. So 40% of the flies in the UK, we don't know what their larvae are.
Wow.
Wow.
They're just like, it's maggot.
Yep.
Yeah. Shrug.
And this is like, it's all fun and giggles.
Yeah.
They realize that they ignore them in, say, soil ecology.
Yeah.
Because they're like, oh, it's a fly, I don't know. And it's like, well, that's probably doing more nutrient recycling than a lot of the other things you're
doing. Right,
there. But you've just ignored it.
Another one of those areas that you're referring to, like how much work still needs to be done.
Yes.
I can hear in my brain my listeners being like, wait, go back. What is this genital rotation thing that you're referring to? So I can't be remiss in asking more about this.
So flies are quite weird. You've seen flies in cop, as we affectionately call it. So they do it in many different ways.
Yeah.
Have you seen bee flies? do you know, mm-hmm. bee flies? Mm-hmm. But the female fly along and she's dragging the male behind her.
Yeah.
And he's facing away and he's like, ugh.
Yeah.
He's holding on with his genitals, as it were.
Yeah.
Which is fun for us.
Yeah.
It's not so fun for him. Then there's a lot of flies that will maybe physically rotate the end of their abdomen so that the mechanism is in a better position for him. Mm-hmm. So he can still lock into her.
Yeah.
But he then isn't being dragged behind.
Right.
So some of the robber flies and things like that, he will rotate the end of his abdomen.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas a lot of the other flies are like, do you know what? Let's just rotate it.
Yeah.
And it's a muscle rotation mm-hmm. to get it into the right position. And some will do 90 degrees. Mm-hmm. Some will do a whole 360.
Yeah.
Really does depend on the organism.
Yeah.
And mosquitoes, I believe it's a 180 rotation mm-hmm. into position. So we'll wait for him to do that. And so then he can do it in the missionary style. I don't know how polite you want to be.
Oh, no.
Okay, that's fine.
That's, it puts the right image into your head. Yeah,
so, you know, actually, it's more doggy style. Sorry, I'm just going to shut up.
Yeah.
there are some flies that they do it head to head.
Yeah.
But that usually ends up in the death of the male.
Oh, wow.
But that's another story.
Yeah.
So, yes, there's all these different mechanisms.
Right.
For him.
Well, thank you so much for coming and talking to me about bloodsuckers.
Thanks.
You have a special place in your heart for parasites, just like I do. So I really appreciate that, hearing your perspectives on, you know, thinking of these animals as
animals.
Organisms. Yeah, and as like a part of our environment.
Yeah.
And but also at the same time being really concerned about diseases and respecting human health and all of that is, I think it's a really important conversation to have that a lot of people aren't necessarily thinking about. So I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
Cheers.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.